From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Ira Melman. The British leader clarifies his stance on what caused the crash of a Russian plane in Egypt. British Prime Minister David Cameron says the crash of a Russian jet in Egypt was more likely than not caused by a bomb. The UK grounded all of its flights to and from Egypt's Sinai Peninsula Wednesday, stranding thousands of British tourists. Two smaller airlines say starting tomorrow they will fly to Sharm el-Sheikh to pick them up. Cameron, the Prime Minister, says he has every sympathy with the Egyptians who rely so heavily on tourism, but that he had to put the safety of British people first. He spoke at 10 Downing Street this morning.
We don't know for certain that it was a terrorist bomb. There's still an investigation taking place in Egypt. We need to see the results of that investigation. The reason we've acted before that is because of intelligence and information we had that gave us the concern that it was more likely than not it was a terrorist bomb. Now, if that turns out to be the case, and even before we have that confirmed, of course we'll look at all of the implications, because my job is to keep British people safe wherever they are in the world, and that means working with partners like the Egyptians to make sure that happens.
The Egyptian leader is in London meeting with the British Prime Minister. The head of Russia's Air Force said Thursday the military has sent anti-aircraft missiles to Syria in order to protect Russian planes conducting airstrikes. Russia's air campaign has come under scrutiny by others operating in the region, particularly the United States, which has been leading a coalition of countries bombing Islamic State militant targets for more than a year. Top U.S. diplomats say the majority of Russian airstrikes in Syria have hit moderate rebels. This is VOA. The UN Refugees Agency says it's expecting up to 5,000 refugees and other migrants a day to arrive in Greece from Turkey over the next 4 months. UNHCR laid out its winter plan Thursday with an appeal for another $96.15 million in funding. It warned about the possibility of more deaths among the thousands of refugees who have been crossing the Aegean if adequate measures are not taken. The agency said its focus is on improving shelter and reception facilities for the winter and providing items like tents, refugee housing units, blankets, and clothing. It says it also hopes to winterize water and sanitation systems. Myanmar's opposition leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, says if her party wins elections this weekend, she will take a post above the president to skirt a ban on her holding the office. Aung San Suu Kyi held a news conference early Thursday in which she announced her plan but did not elaborate. She said only, "I will be above the president. It is a very simple message." She's banned from holding the office by a constitutional provision that says candidates with foreign-born spouses or offspring cannot be president. VOA's Steve Herman is in Yangon.
She has built up over many decades quite a positive reputation with much of the electorate here. Of course, in 1990, her party, the National League for Democracy, won, but she was prevented, despite that resounding victory, from basically taking over the government and was put under house arrest on and off for many, many years.
During her comments to the media, Aung San Suu Kyi also said she's concerned about whether election results will adequately respond to allegations of irregularities in the preparation for the Sunday vote. But she added that it is important for her party to form a government of national reconciliation if the National League for Democracy wins the election. The U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter visited a U.S. aircraft carrier in the South China Sea Thursday as tensions grow with China over Beijing's maritime expansion in the region. Carter was traveling with his Malaysian counterpart, Hisamuddin Hussein. The two boarded the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt as it sailed the South China Sea off the coast of Malaysia. In announcing his visit on Wednesday, Carter said it is a symbol of our commitment to the region and to focusing more U.S. attention on the Asian Pacific nations after years of focus on the Middle East. The latest U.S. political survey shows two political novices, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump and retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, in a dead heat for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Thank you.
Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we speak with an expert about the meaning of possible ISIS involvement in the downing of a Russian plane. We discuss the possibility of a political resolution to the Syrian crisis. We continue our conversation with Chef Bibi about his chocolate chip cookie.
When I see them bite into it, literally their taste buds just begin to dance.
And we'll hear who won what at the Country Music Awards. It's right here on the Voice of America. As Britain hosted Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, British officials say evidence points to the detonation of an explosive device as the cause of Saturday's mid-air breakup and crash of a Russian jetliner after it departed Sharm el-Sheikh Airport in the Sinai, bound for St. Petersburg, Russia. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Victor.
Susan, tragically, all 224 people on board that aircraft perished. On Wednesday, British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond spoke after meeting with his government's Crisis Response Committee.
We have concluded that there is a significant possibility that that crash was caused by an explosive device on board the aircraft. Earlier this evening, we delayed the return to the UK of British-bound flights that were on the ground at Sharm el-Sheikh while we conducted a review of security at the airport. We have people on the ground working with the Egyptians, and I'd like to pay tribute to the Egyptian authorities who have been extremely cooperative throughout the day and have moved heaven and earth to meet our demands on the ground. But unfortunately, and very reluctantly this evening, we have concluded that we have to change our travel advice, and we are now advising against all but essential travel by air through Sharm el-Sheikh Airport.
On Wednesday, a White House spokesman said U.S. air safety experts had warned commercial airlines months ago that they were at potential risk associated with extremist activity if they flew over the Sinai. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina told me that if it's determined the IS group was behind the destruction of the aircraft, it will only be the first jihadist effort against Russia for its intervention in Syria.
Much more will be done against the Russians. They opened the Pandora box by their intervention in Syria, and they will unleash revenge. There will be revenge activities by Islamic organizations. So whether this one is the first or not, there will be more.
Do you suggest that perhaps this is one of the reasons why Russia is pushing fast for some sort of political solution in Syria?
That could be one of the reasons. I think that the Russians are having a strategy in Syria which is designed to show that, A, they can decide the situation militarily, but they can also bring about a political solution.
Egyptian President el-Sisi had indicated that the Islamic State initial claim of responsibility was merely propaganda. Mr. el-Sisi's image, has that been damaged? He claims that the situation in Sinai is under full control.
Hey, look, the Egyptians have a sure interest here in minimizing the damage. It's a damage control activity on the part of the president, and one can understand it. Don't forget that tourism is a very important part of their economy, and tourism in the Sinai mostly. So if flights will be canceled now, or there won't be flights by a lot of international carriers to the Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, that's a major damage to the Egyptian economy. So they have an interest in minimizing damage by pretending it wasn't a terror activity. If security in Sharm el-Sheikh Airport was compromised, where else can it be compromised in Egypt? That's a real problem here for the Egyptians.
Joseph Olmert says by intervening in Syria, Russia has created a situation that invites jihadist revenge attacks. Trinity University regional analyst David Lesh told me he agrees.
It had to come in some form, in my opinion. That it happened in the Sinai Peninsula was somewhat unexpected. But once the Russians had intervened in Syria, it was predictable that elements of the, particularly the Islamic State and other jihadist elements who, you know, made up of such groups as Chechens and others who had been wanting to kill Russians for some time, would carry out attacks against the Russians, either Russian troops or installations or whatever. And I think that will come. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I think the interesting point now is what will the Russians do? when the evidence mounts that this was an attack that was precipitated by Russian military interaction, will they enhance and increase their military footprint in Syria? And is this the beginning of the quagmire in which the Russians will get themselves into that many people have predicted? So I think the Russians are, and Putin is in particular, is very much concerned over this and very much concerned over what will likely be increasing attacks against Russian interests, not only in Syria, but as if this proves to be the case, Russian interests outside of Syria and in Russia itself. And will this compel Putin and the Kremlin to increase their military footprint in Syria? Will it compel them to draw back?
Russia's involvement only extends about a month, their air campaign really beginning in earnest on September the 30th. Were you surprised how quickly the IS took off after Russian targets?
I'm a little surprised that it was IS, because as we know now, most of the Russian strikes until this time have been directed at non-IS opposition to the Assad regime. There have been a few attacks against IS positions in Syria, but 95% of the Russian airstrikes have been against Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of Conquest, and other elements that have been most threatening to the Assad regime.
David Lesh says if the IS group is found to be responsible for downing the aircraft, it will be a further incentive for Russia to seek a political solution in Syria.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Let's have a look now at what people are saying about the Russian plane crash on social media. Michael Lippin joins me in the studio with an update. Michael, what Twitter hashtag should people search for?
Hi, Susan. Well, the most widely used hashtag for tweets about the crash remains 7K9268. That was the flight number of the Metrojet plane. The Topsy Analytics website shows that it's been mentioned in more than 3,000 tweets in the past day and 125,000 times in the last week. Other popular hashtags that I've seen include Metrojet and Sinai crash. Now, just to pick up on a point that analyst David Lesh mentioned to Victor Beatty, expressing surprise that the Islamic State may have carried out a major attack against Russia, assuming that the crash actually was an IS bombing. Now, I've seen that sentiment also expressed in some recent tweets, including by a satirical Twitter account that claims to be the voice of Russian President Putin. That account uses the handle @DarthPutinKGB, and it has 40,000 followers. And this is what it tweeted: Russia isn't bombing ISIS, so why is ISIS bombing Russia?
What's the general feeling of Russian social media users about this crash?
Well, it's been a major topic of discussion among Russian-speaking Twitter users in the past few days. Some of them believe the crash may have been an act of revenge by terrorists. One user with the handle Markov_Alexei tweeted, "There was an explosion in the back of the cabin, immediate depressurization and death within seconds." And then he asks the question, "Was it a response to Russia for its involvement in Syria?" Well, others blame the disaster on poor quality control. Twitter user Good Uncle Klaus tweeted, "Carelessness and corruption during safety checks is worse than terrorism." I should also point out that many Russian speakers are not playing the blame game. They're just expressing the grief that appears to have gripped much of their country. A user with the handle Ram_Nastya said this about the victims of the crash: "The tears are rolling down my cheeks. Rest in peace." Susan?
Sad, Michael. Thank you very much for that report, though. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's been long known that evolution has guided human development to adapt to changing environments over the years. Now, new findings by U.S. and French researchers suggest that our language abilities have also adapted to our local environment. The researchers examined languages spoken throughout today's world and compared their sound structures with climatic and ecological factors. Ian Madison from the University of New Mexico says that he and his colleagues found that the number of distinct consonants in a language and how they are grouped together are related to the precipitation, temperature, tree cover, and elevation of an area in which the language evolved. The researchers say their findings support a theory which suggests animal species adjust the sounds they make so that they can be transmitted more efficiently in the environment they live in. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has highlighted the need to decide which of the various opposition groups fighting in Syria should be part of future peace talks and which should be considered terrorists. Lavrov spoke at a news conference after meeting in Moscow with the UN envoy for Syria about the process of finding a political solution to the conflict that has left more than 240,000 people dead since March 2011. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Michael O'Hanlon, director of research at the Brookings Institution, about the new U.S. strategy in Syria and prospects of a political transition. And he joins me now. Welcome, Mohamed.
Thank you.
See, Mohamed, the Vienna talks hit a hurdle with regard to the future of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad because both Moscow and Tehran are insisting he should stay in power.
Well, that position has changed this week when a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said Tuesday that Moscow does not consider it a matter of principle that Assad must stay in power. However, Michael O'Hanlon gave a vote of no confidence in the Russian statement.
Well, I'm skeptical about what Russia has said. I'm skeptical about their sincerity. But I also think that if we keep in mind the idea of a confederal model, then, in fact, we could have a role for Assad in the Alawite sector, and that perhaps would provide the natural compromise. So I still think that there is a way, if you take this sort of Bosnia model or confederation model, and you attempt to employ that, there may be a way to compromise.
O'Hanlon argues that the only hope for Syria as a united country is to have a very loose, weak central government with autonomous zones as a realistic outcome for a political solution.
The U.S. is deploying some special forces into Syria. Some experts said deploying less than 50 U.S. special forces to Syria could add combat effectiveness in the fight against ISIS. But others called it a Band-Aid.
Well, Michael O'Hanlon was in the middle and said while it's not enough for a comprehensive strategy for the U.S., it has its own merits.
But it's a step in the right direction because, let's say it's 40 people, they can begin to establish better contact with the various opposition forces. They can begin to understand the lay of the land, the geography, the logistical requirements. They can perhaps give some overall advice on a couple of general principles of battle. They can forge personal relationships, which I think are crucial in this sort of situation. And perhaps in a couple of limited cases, they could even do a better job of forward air control or tactical air control. But I think to do that kind of tactical work, they're going to need to be increased. But even so, even without the increase, you could have a little bit of that effect initially.
However, O'Hanlon said the new strategy is not yet working because it is still evolving, and if the goal remains to defeat ISIL and ultimately to put pressure on Assad to negotiate a political transition, there is a lot to be done down the road.
Well, thank you, Mohamed, for that analysis.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, vanilla might be a key to a really good chocolate chip cookie. And country music's biggest night. Today we continue our conversation with Chef Francis Nelson Beebe, chef and owner of Mr. Nelson's Cookies, about chocolate chip cookies and their popularity. Chef, what makes your chocolate chip cookies better than my mother's?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think I would compete with any mother's chocolate chip cookie. You know, mom is mom, and you're going to have a taste that's uniquely mom's. And it's interesting because I have that question asked many, many times, even though I have an online business. Occasionally on the weekends, I'm at farmers markets. And when people see me advertising the perfect chocolate chip cookie, they say, well, my mom makes the chocolate chip cookie. And I guess my response to that is that's probably true and I won't compete with mom, but it's always good to have a backup. And my backup is Mr. Nelson's Cookies. And what I believe makes it, you know, perfect from my standpoint, I was actually a Mr. Mom. I was a single parent some 30 years ago. And my son and his buddies just love chocolate chip cookies. And I literally made thousands of them and tried, you know, call it tens of, not hundreds of different recipes, and then kind of took something from another, until I created what I thought was the, you know, the quintessential chocolate chip cookie recipe. I have three levels of chocolate. in my chocolate chip cookie, and a very exclusive vanilla. I use Tahitian vanilla. Most vanillas come out of either Madagascar or Mexico. And Tahitian vanilla has a lot of layers and complexities that the others do not. And it seems to love chocolate. It just adores chocolate. And when I watch people take a sample, again, at the farmer's market, I have them smell it first because 80% of your taste comes from smell. And then when I see them bite into it, literally their taste buds just begin to dance, almost metaphorically, if you will, where the vanilla seems to be hugging the different levels of chocolate. So it's a recipe that I created a long time ago, put it in my back pocket. But when I now shared it in the last 15 months that I've basically been live in terms of making Mr. Nelson's cookies, it seems like I may not have taken mom's place, but I'm a pretty close second.
And you only make chocolate chip cookies, is that correct?
That's correct. You know, and my dad said, you know, it's okay to be a one-trick pony, just make it a really good trick, you know. And I seem to have gotten the endorsement of a lot of people where they don't even question, do you sell an oatmeal? Do you sell a peanut butter? They just seem to be very, very satisfied that my cookie, which just weighs a couple grams under a few grams under a quarter of a pound, it's an awful lot of cookie. And people's when I see the taste and the eyes roll back in the head, I know that I've conjured up all those earlier memories that we're talking about, maybe even surpassed them.
Well, thank you so much, Chef Beebe, for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A navigation device for your bicycle that attaches to the handlebars. It's called Smart Halo, and it's made by a company called Cycle Labs. It's a circular screen edged by a ring of LED lights. It connects to an app on your smartphone via Bluetooth. A right turn is indicated by a right side green semicircle. For a slight left turn, a green quarter circle appears at the top left, and U-turns light up a red semicircle on the bottom of the display. Here's Cycle Labs' Gabriel Albarol.
So we've made sure our device was simple, yet smart. How? By reducing its interface to its simplest possible form, a circle. This luminous halo allows us to communicate an impressive amount of information.
Smart Halo is also a bike locator, a theft prevention device, and a fitness tracker. Its bright headlight turns on and off automatically on a battery charge that normally lasts 3 weeks. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
One of the biggest events in country music happened last night, the Country Music Association Awards, the CMAs. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to fill us all in. Welcome, Nikki.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you. Hey, first, who won what?
Okay. All right. So, Female Vocalist of the Year, Miranda Lambert. Male Vocalist of the Year, Chris Stapleton. Vocal Group of the Year, Little Big Town, well-deserved, Girl Crush. Their song actually won for Song of the Year. Vocal Duo of the Year, Florida Georgia Line. New Artist of the Year was Chris Stapleton. And Entertainer of the Year was Luke Bryan.
Do any of these surprise you?
Okay, so this is what excited me.
Uh-huh.
And that is, and this ties into Justin Timberlake coming on the show. Chris Stapleton was like the underdog that cleaned up. So he was able to take away three awards for Male Vocalist of the Year, Album of the Year, New Artist of the Year. Now, even though he's a well-respected songwriter and singer, he's written for Adele, he's written for a lot of big names in country music, and people love his work. However, his solo project, this is his first solo debut, came out in May and has not had the commercial push and the awareness that his other nominees have had. So in these award ceremonies, sometimes you're like, okay, is it gonna the most popular going to win, or is it the one with best quality? And so his album Traveler was well respected and well received. So the fact that he wound up picking up three of the awards encouraged and inspired everybody. All country music lovers, the artists and the nominees alike. So much so that when Luke Bryan got up to accept his award as Entertainer of the Year, he even expressed his excitement about how well Chris has done that evening. So that, I think, was the biggest surprise, in addition, of course, to Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, I was going to say, Justin Timberlake.
I heard
he blew people out of the water with his duet.
Oh, my goodness. So, and the thing is, Justin Timberlake is doing the duet with Chris Stapleton on the stage, and they're doing the cut, Tennessee Whiskey. It's like a bluesy, I don't want to say jazzy, it's more of like a blues cut on the country music spectrum. And tears it up. It was amazing. So no one was expecting it. And then for it to be with Chris Stapleton and for it to be that cut and for it to be as phenomenal as it was, that just added to the excitement and the inspiration. And by the way, Justin Timberlake has showed up and has been a part of a couple of high-profile country music events. And, you know, he's a Tennessee native. So there is buzz that he might be working on a country album without really letting us know.
Unless he can really do anything, any kind of form of music.
He can.
Why are these CMAs so important?
Okay, so the CMAs, so their objectives are pretty much to guide and enhance the development of country music throughout the world and to demonstrate it as a viable medium to advertisers and consumers and media. And basically, they see themselves also as an agent for unity within the country music industry, and their award show really encapsulates all of that. And so the actors have their Emmys, the country music artists have the CMAs.
Yeah, it really brings attention to country music, and most people might not be exposed
to it. Exactly. And this is a great way, especially with Justin. That's a great tie-in. And there's been a lot of crossover country pop artists, but this is really the night where country artists get to shine on their own.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced this month that it is listing the military and great green macaws as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Both bird species are endemic to Central and South America. The agency found that both species are in decline, primarily due to habitat loss, fragmentation and degradation, small population size, and poaching. Further, the existing regulatory mechanisms designed to protect these macaws are not adequate to prevent those threats from impacting them throughout their ranges. As a result, both macaws are at risk of extinction throughout their ranges. The military macaw inhabits tropical, semi-deciduous forests in Mexico and South America. Although it is a large distribution, its population, ranging from 6,000 to 13,000 adults, is highly fragmented into small, localized groups, ranging from a few pairs to approximately 100 individuals. The great green macaw occupies humid, tropical forests primarily in Central America and parts of northern South America. Its population, now ranging from 1,000 to 3,000 individuals, is in decline. The service recognizes the valuable, ongoing conservation efforts to protect these species by a number of private individuals, national and local governments, and non-governmental organizations, including the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fundación ProAves. These efforts include providing training to local communities to monitor populations and studying species via satellite transmitters to determine the species' home range and specific habitat. However, in spite of these notable contributions, great green and military macaw populations continue to decline. As a result of this listing, certain activities involving these two bird species will be prohibited without a permit, including import into and export out of the United States, take, defined by the Endangered Species Act as harm, harass, kill, or injure, within the United States, and interstate and foreign commerce. By regulating these activities, the Endangered Species Act ensures that U.S. citizens and individuals subject to the jurisdiction of the United States do not contribute to the further decline of the.
Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Simpuga. This evening we'll talk about the European migration crisis, especially the growing number of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. And with us tonight is Skofre Nana Yau Yeboah. He's a media analyst and is joining us by phone from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Mr. Yeboah. I think he's not on the line yet. We'll try to get him on the line again. Meanwhile, we also have our regular panelist, Lemar Mugula. He's an independent political analyst. He joins us from Durban, South Africa, as usual. Good evening, Suleiman. Do we have Suleiman? It appears we are having some issues with our phone lines to both Durban and Accra. But as soon as we reconnect with our panelists, we'll continue our discussion of the migrant crisis, especially those migrants from sub-Saharan Africa trying to get their way into Europe, looking either fleeing conflict or poverty or whatever. Meanwhile, the unprecedented numbers of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa say they are stranded on Africa's Mediterranean coastal countries of Algeria, Morocco, and Libya. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, acknowledges the plight of these migrants is not a new crisis. For those in Libya, they say most left their home countries to work there when things were still okay. And for others, IOM says the route westward to Spain has been a heavily traveled one for decades. Now hundreds of thousands of migrants say they are stranded in these countries, living in abandoned buildings, begging for money to complete their journey to Europe. IOM spokesperson Itaya Viriri says those migrants stranded in Morocco have a different set of circumstances from those in Libya. My colleague Kim Lewis talked to him.
Well, the particular numbers that we're talking of in Libya, these are people who were there even before Gaddafi was toppled. As you know, before Gaddafi was removed from power, there was a significant number of, I would say several hundred thousands of sub-Saharan Africans who made their living in Libya because, you know, there was a lot of work in the oil sector and a lot of construction that was going on. And to the effect that, in fact, when the conflict began and the International Organization for Migration was one of the agencies that actually repatriated several thousands of sub-Saharan Africans who wanted to go home, you know, to places like Cameroon, Chad, and quite a few countries in West Africa. So the numbers are not just new arrivals, but people who have been there for a long time who now find that the situation in Libya is quite untenable. Security-wise, it's very dangerous for them. And the option that they're taking now is to try and continue on to Europe instead of maybe going back to their countries of origin.
Now, these are people that also applies to Morocco as well.
Indeed, yes. Yes. The same conditions that I just referred to in terms of access to employment would prevail in quite a number of North African countries. But until now, in places like Libya, they'd be happy to stay there and not consider going on to Europe. Morocco is slightly different in that it's obviously certainly more at peace for people who are waiting to go to Europe.
Those migrants that are in Morocco that are from sub-Saharan Africa, they say that they're invisible, that they have just been ignored and they're pretty much stuck there. They can't get home, they can't get to Europe, and they can't get employment there. So what will the country do about that?
The IOM has a program that can assist people voluntarily do so. But I presume in this case, if they want to go to Europe, because Morocco is not in the same situation as Libya, that there's a governing authority, you know, they are probably not allowing them to get onto boats the same way that is happening in Libya, where there's no real government in place or a real authority that can stop them getting onto the boat. So I think that's the main difference. But I would also say that in many cases, the dynamics are very different, and therefore you have a situation that maybe they might feel that they're ignored because everyone's focus is on Libya. the fact that the authority there is not stopping people trying to get onto the boat and trying to get to Europe.
So what does the future hold then for those migrants who they say they're stranded in Morocco?
One thing definitely that we can, as the International Organization for Migration, say is that if they are really, you know, desperately need to go back home, the IOM does provide a service where they get support to go back. And also in many cases, they get reintegration support. Our office in Rabat should be able to assist them with that. And we experience across many countries where we can certainly, over a period of time, assist large numbers to return. As I said, we did that in Libya, where several thousand sub-Saharan Africans were assisted to return home. But if they want to continue on to Europe, we don't have a facility to help them do that. But the main thing is that we can certainly help them make right choices, and we give them the information on what they need to do. And then it's up to them to decide whether they want to go back home or they want to continue on to Europe.
That was IOM spokesperson Itai Viriri. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis while traveling through Europe. And now I understand we have our panelists back online after going through this task of getting phone lines in Africa working properly. And as I said, we have Scroffrey Nanayao Eboa, a media analyst, joining us from Accra. And regular panelist Suleiman Mugula is back with us now. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
Yeah, I hope you heard that brief report from my colleague talking about the plight of these migrants. Now, for our listeners, as the world watches hundreds of thousands of Syrians crossing into Europe from the east, territories north of Sahara are filling with comparable numbers of Africans determined to make their own entrance. Migrants from more than a dozen African nations are descending on Morocco, Algeria, and Libya in unprecedented numbers, sleeping in abandoned apartments, derelict warehouses, and even on city streets. Thousands are living in fast-expanding forest encampments, surviving off garbage and stolen water. Now, let's take that from there. Let me begin in Accra to Mr. Eboa there. This must be a dire situation for some of these guys.
Trouble
getting hearing you correctly because of the poor network. Let's try to call you again and then we'll continue. But meanwhile, let me talk to Suleiman. We are going to call you back in a moment. Suleiman, we had difficulty hearing our brother from Accra. People driven to this extent of having to take these risks speaks of a lot of problems on the continent, doesn't it?
No doubt about it. Our people who are moving, they are moving well aware of the problems ahead. They know the consequences. Since the beginning of this year, the boats have been drowning around Lampedusa, around Libya. The estimate is around 2,600 drowned so far. They know some of them go through hardship to go through the deserts. They are abused. Actually, it is abuse. It's a crime against humanity, what is happening right now. To put it simple, we have got a silent crisis on the continent. People know the difficulties, but that one tells us how difficult, how worse the push factors have become. The continent has become unbearable. Young people are moving not because they want to go, but they prefer to die in dignity over the seas than dying in shame in their particular country. It is very shameful. It is a crisis, and it is increasing. It is not stopping. What is more surprising and what is more disturbing, Douglas, is that this is not only an Africa towards Europe migration. We also have an internal migration within the continent itself. South Africa at the moment is facing, and it has been facing, an influx of immigrants again from the African continent. Name any country. If you go down Johannesburg, you'll find Johannesburg inundated with immigrants from African countries, from Zimbabwe, Swaziland, Zambia, DRC, you continue Uganda, up to Eritrea and Somalia, Ethiopia, all the part of them are flocking into South Africa. So it is a double crisis, both not only for the European countries, but also for the African countries whose economies are doing well.
I see. Let me see if we have our other panelists online now. Do we have him? I think we don't have. Well, I don't think we don't have him yet. Now, Suleiman, as you mentioned, this is a dire situation. What, if anything, are governments doing to help the situation? I mean, African governments.
Of course, by the fact that people have decided to run away from this particular country, it shows you the attitude of their particular government. You realize, Douglas, ever since the death started, ever since the drowning started in the Mediterranean, no African country has raised a finger to try to help. Number two, people run away from this African country because there has been failure of governance in these particular countries. What are the push factors? We have got countries which have almost made little progress towards the creation of opportunities in their particular countries. Let's take countries like Eritrea. I mean, if you look at the countries which push immigrants to Europe and within Africa, Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, Uganda, Cameroon, Gambia, Chad, Sudan, Southern Sudan, Sudan itself, Central African Republic, DRC, most of these countries are poorly governed. These are countries where we have got dictators. Let's take a country like Uganda. What should make a Ugandan, a young person, to stay in Uganda? For 30 years, the country has had one leader. And within this one leader, with this regime, within 30 years, you don't have, there is no substantial economic activity. Agriculture has collapsed. There is no industrialization. There is no sensible trade going on. There is no other programs like public works. Some of those which are carried on are so small. So you'll find that for many years, it has not been able to have economic policies which can create employment for its people. As a result, young people who have waited for years, maybe someone has waited for 20 years for a job, he cannot find a job. He has tried to sell things on the street. He cannot make it. That is why he prefers to take the risk and go to Europe. So is the same in Central African Republic. So is the same in Gambia. So is the same in Cameroon. So is the same in Eritrea. So the push factors are the leadership itself. The major push factor is the leadership which has made stagnant, which has remained stagnant, which has remained without any creativity, which is rotten, which is rusty, and which does not give hope to these particular young people who are running away from these particular countries.
Is there a sense that some of these leaders understand the problem, or are they oblivious to these conditions that lead their people to flee their countries?
Most of the generation of African leaders whom we have, they seem to have gone into power by accident. As you recall, some of them had to fight guerrilla wars to go into power. They were not elected into power. So they became leaders by accident. They don't have plans of how to lead. At the moment, after staying in power for so many years, you find that some of them now, they are just living luxurious lives. If you look, for example, if you look at the delegations which people took the United Nations in your place there, the type of delegations, the countries, these poor countries were carrying on. If you look at the lifestyle of these particular leaders which they are leading, look at a leader like Dia of Cameroon, who spends most of his time in holidays in France and elsewhere. Look at a leader like Uganda, like Museveni in Uganda, who prides himself to be among the richest people in the country, whereas he's having poor people. Look at the situation in Uganda or in any one of these countries, Cameroon. The big people themselves, the politicians, they go for treatment abroad. The hospitals have collapsed. So the leaders themselves are oblivious of what is happening to their citizens. They are just enjoying themselves. They think that leadership, as far as they are concerned, is about their lives and their families' lives.
Well, okay, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back to continue our discussion of the European migration crisis, the growing number of migrants are from sub-Saharan Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the European migration crisis, the growing number of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. Our panelists are Skofre Nana Yao Yaboa, a media analyst from Accra, Ghana, and Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst, and I'm your host, Douglas Simpuga, here in Studio 9. Skofre, are you there now?
Yes, I can hear
you loud and clear. Yes, a bit clearer now. Most of all, Suleiman's contribution was putting the blame on the poor governance on the continent as the cause of this crisis. What do you think?
Well, I cannot disagree with him, because if you want to look at this, I call it, it's a pandemic. This crisis is a pandemic stage. It is the same equivalent as we have the Ebola crisis. The pandemic has three phases: economical situation, we have political situation, and we have the social factor. Let's pick it from the political, which actually encapsulates economic challenges. If you look at about six countries that have a lot of citizens, especially their youth, transiting through the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. You can mention Eritrea, you can mention Gambia, you can mention Nigeria, you can mention Algeria, you can mention Sudan, you can mention Chad. All these countries are mentioning, as we speak, have political instability. These countries are countries that have been dealt with in sentences from, let's say, like Boko Haram and its Al-Qaeda network system. So from this perspective, people who want to have a safe haven for the sake of political instability will exodus through any other means that they desire. And we all agree that since independence era in the 1960s, where Africans were so much keen in building the dream Africa that their forefathers and forefathers died for, after that period of 1966 upwards, today, that particular dream that will motivate young Africans to stay home to build the kind of Africa that their forefathers died for, it is no longer there. So I agree with my brother on the other line that although we are able to fashion out, if you consider the African Union Commission's charter, the youth charter, you realize that we have played lip service to this charter, which actually should have been the blueprint of the vista to catapult the African youth into an era where we will mastermind our own development. Having faith in our system is one of the daunting tasks facing African youth, that if he or she is not able to contain the pressure, he will want to use every means available to travel outside the continent. And that is the saddest part. We have known this. The challenge is always that we have known this when it was like symptoms. It's such a simple, slow movement. So now that's wicked crisis crescendo, which needs a holistic approach. Because when we have political instability, when we have our governments not having the political will, when we have our governments not necessarily putting structures in place that will mitigate youth unemployment, but rather we love to drive a flashy car, rather we want to push us to an education system that makes us not sufficient. We don't have a proficient educational system across Africa that will equip the African youth to have the skill or the requisite skill or oriented skill that will want him to stay home and develop. Now, look at how difficult it is to access credit as a startup. Oh, it is very, very difficult across in Africa for startups to permeate into the system. I always want to cite WhatsApp, for example. I want to cite Spain, for example. Look at their ages when they broke into the limelight. We have the same corresponding youth who are doing similar things. But startup in Africa is being stifled by political situation that has not promoted youth development. And any nation that has political instability has economic challenges as well.
I see. Suleiman, given all that, these African migrants are having it hard both ways, because as you see in Europe now, the hundreds of thousands of Syrians fleeing the war back home. Their plight in Europe has drawn international attention, and some of them are being processed. But despite the fact that many thousands are from Africa, those Africans who are fleeing conflict and other kinds of persecutions or whatever, and poverty, they are having it tougher to get asylum in Europe. So they are being pushed from both sides.
No doubt about it. And we can only blame Europe, because Europe is partly responsible for massaging these dictators on the continent. Europe has been pouring money in terms of loan through bilateral or through international organizations like IMF and World Bank, but they have not followed up where this money has gone. This money has been siphoned by leaders, and they are returning it back into Europe. They are banking in Europe, they are enjoying in Europe, they are having their children being educated in Europe on the very money which they give, the Europeans give to the poor countries. So partly, the tragedy is the European countries themselves are perpetuating the suffering of the Africans by failing to tackle or to caution or to engage the dictators to have better economic policies. Right now, the generation which we have is blind. Look at our agriculture industry in Africa. It has been collapsing. We cannot even add value to the agriculture products which we are producing. We are given AGOA by the Americans, but a few countries have been able to benefit from it, and nobody is putting the question. Instead, they are trying to find ways to help those who can be helped. Our people in Africa are facing a double tragedy. The leadership on the continent is rusty and useless, and the leadership in Europe is not giving them asylum, and it's not even trying to find out what is the cause of their migrating from their particular countries, so that they can be able to solve the problem from the source instead of trying to attend to them from Europe.
Now, just before we go, gentlemen, beginning with you, Suleiman, there are some reports of some African leaders encouraging their people to go, just go, wherever you want to go, go, so that you can... And some of them have ended in the Gulf countries where they are virtually treated as slaves, and some of them have died. There are reports from some people from Uganda, Kenya, who have been brutalized in conditions in the Gulf countries. Some of them have died. What do you have to comment about such leaders who encourage their people to simply go wherever they want to go?
It is a sign of failure, because many of these people have not been able, number one, to create opportunities for these people. It is good riddance for them when they go to relieve the pressure of those walking the street. Number two, they have not been able to create any economic opportunities. The industries are down. The agricultural sector is down. So if some of them, those who are exporting minerals, they are exporting minerals and they are siphoning the money. So some of them, to augment their foreign reserve, when they have got so many migrants in foreign countries, the remittances are helping them a lot. So they are exporting these people so that they can get foreign currency. Mm-hmm. That is the paradox about it. In other words, they are selling labor to other foreign countries so that they can get foreign exchange. That is why these poor dictators are using their own people so that they can get them. Otherwise, there is nothing sensible. It is a sign of failure of their economic policies.
Scoffrey, in the last 30 seconds, what's your thought on that?
Explained in what is happening now. If you have a region that we call the Western imperialists or neocolonialists, who fought his governance system when Africans had to take a time for liberation, and they went behind the doors to make sure that the African continent and its countries are not fully fledged economically and politically independent, this is what they are to pay for. This is something that they cannot say they don't have their hand poised on. If you look at a lot of research on America, that has involved itself in a lot of coup d'etat overthrows to put in place more threats that they can even control. This is what happens. Now, let's get to the leaders. Most African leaders are suffering from what I call intellectual and affluent witchcraft. And these are leaders who don't see beyond the tomorrow, who have sight but are endemic with short-sightedness. That is why they are easily looking at, okay, you can go and bring remittances. Apparently, the amount of money that Western powers entities that are coming out of Africa alone is bigger than the remittances that our citizens send from abroad. That is the sad reality. In certain jurisdictions, every big entity, manufacturing entity, is in the hands of Westerners. Anything that Africa gets is solely raw materials we export. If you want to add value to anything in Africa, there are international standards being set in place to make sure that you don't permeate through the market like what I mentioned, AGOA.
Yes.
How many countries can we say in Africa?
Unfortunately, yes, we are out of time, my friend Scoffrey. It appears that's all the time we have for this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I think we'll revisit this topic because it's very important to the people there. I'd like to thank our panel, Skofre Nana Yaboa, a media analyst in Accra, and Suleiman Mugula, a South African-based independent vulcanist. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show. And we'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington, wishing you all the best.